You are listening to the Punk News Podcast. We've got a very special episode. We are here with Adam Fletcher. And listen, people, I need to give everyone a little bit of a preamble here, a little bit of an explanation. And actually, Adam, I should ask you before I start recording, but I didn't, and we just organized. Did you speak to your PR person before we set up this interview?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
I mean, I did. I mean, I talked to Vanessa, like she set it up, but I mean, I didn't talk to her about anything.
Okay. Well, Adam, I give Adam much props, and here's why. The listeners might be like, why is John interviewing the copyrights? Didn't John just spend like 10 minutes on like three episodes ago talking about how much he didn't like the copyrights and he thought they were all nice people, but he wasn't a fan of the band? And then the next day I get an email. Did Vanessa tell you that?
No, I don't know anything about this. Oh, okay. This is great, though. This is good.
So I get an email from Vanessa, and that's their PR person, and she says, do you want to interview the copyrights? And at first I'm like, well, I didn't really like the music, you know, so I'm going to say no. But then I'm thinking, well, that's kind of bullshit, because really back in the day, if you look at the golden age of rock journalism in the 70s, the interviewers weren't always fans of the bands, and sometimes they were haters. And I'm not necessarily a fan of like hate interviews where they attack the band at all, you know, and I didn't want to be two-faced. So I said to Vanessa, I said, you know, I'm not a really big fan of the band, but all the Punk News listeners, all the Punk News readers love this band. So it'd be interesting if I interviewed them because I'm not a fan. And she says, well, let me check. And she gets back and here we are. So I give,
here we are. Huge, all right.
I give huge props to Adam for coming on and having the guts to come on. And the point of this interview isn't for John to attack the copyrights, because that's not what I'm going to do. And the point isn't, can we make John a fan? That's not the point. The point is an honest and almost a non-biased discussion about the band. Before we even get into that, Adam, we're speaking with Adam Fletcher. Adam, you and I are going to be great friends because you and I are big fans of a obscure 7-inch. Nubs, Little Billy's Burning, Got a Job, right?
Nubs?
Yeah.
What? I don't know.
And missing here. There's an interview from 2014 where someone asks you, like, what's your favorite punk record? And you say the 7-inch Nubs.
Oh, I do. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, all right. Sorry. I had to think about that for a little bit. Yeah. That's funny. 2007. Wow. You're digging way back there, buddy.
Well, listen, we have to do the research for Adam. You know what I mean? So let's talk about Nubs is an amazing forgotten band. Just what does Nubs mean? If the listeners don't know, Nubs were a San Francisco band, late 70s, and they put out one 7-inch and then a comp with some like tracks recorded later, and it's an amazing 7-inch called I Got a Job, and the flip side is Little Billy's Burning. Anyway, it's a very aggressive sounding kind of NorCal Germs type 7-inch, if you will. What does the Nub 7-inch mean to you?
At the time, it was just probably what I was listening to at that moment. Fair enough, yeah. But I do love old punk, and particularly like West Coast punk. I love all punk. I'm a connoisseur of all punk. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, that the West Coast scene of the late 70s, early 80s, man, that whole, like, well, the LA stuff, the Danger House scene.
Danger House.
Love that stuff. And, you know,
what's
I first heard
Danger
about
House 7-inch? What's Danger that? House 7-inch. Like, what's your favorite My Danger favorite? House 7-inch? Yeah.
Probably Rhino 39.
See, everyone always goes for X, and I'm like, X is cool, but they are far from my favorite. You know, I'm digging Black Randy, or I'm digging Howard Worth, like the
Oh, yeah, Obsolete. You know? Yeah. Yeah, those bands that only made one record, and then that was it. You know, they probably definitely had more songs. They just never got recorded or documented. But I love that kind of obscurity of punk, where it's just like the old punk single where, like, these are the two songs that we recorded in a real studio, and this is all that ever existed of the band. And they're usually awesome. Like, you know, it's usually like the two best songs that they picked out of the whole catalog of music. But that kind of obscurity of like, this is it, and this is all that ever existed, and there's no like 10 albums for them to fall off and get shitty, you know.
See, I agree with you on the West, and we're already getting off the tangent, but I mean, you're in no rush, right? Are we limited to 15 minutes, or you got time to hang out?
I got time, man.
All right, man. So, Adam, you and I are already jiving. I'm glad about this. So anyway, I think you and I are on the same page with regard, and we'll definitely get to the copyrights of the new album, and we're going to get to all that. But right now, Adam and I are feeling each other out. You know, we're seeing what the deal is. But so anyway, I love the West Coast 7-inch, and I agree with you 100%. However, you know, right now, record collecting is crazy. Prices are through the roof. I don't know if you're – are you a record collector?
I do collect records.
Yeah, so, you know, right now, like, some obscure, like, Australian punk band from 1980 that put out one record, or some obscure band from Scotland from 1981 that put out one record, like, people spend $800, $1,000 for those records, and a lot of those are just pretty good. They're not great, you know what I mean? So I think, for some reason, those West Coast 7, it's just every single one's a banger. But, like, from other parts, not as much. Maybe you disagree.
I mean, it's hit or miss. I don't know. There's things... There's obscure bands from all over that made great records. The LA scene had, and San Francisco too. I don't know. There's good bands from all over. I just love that idea of like that kind of obscurity. It's actually, you know, it costs $800 to buy that artifact because it's an artifact. There were only a finite number of those that were ever produced. So the fact that you're going to get one, it's going to cost you money. You can listen to it anywhere. You can listen to it on Spotify. So it's not necessarily elitist in the way of like the only way you're ever going to hear this. Sometimes it is. Some of the most expensive ones are the ones that aren't on the internet. You know, they're just streaming on YouTube somewhere. So, I mean, I guess that really does push it up until you know, you're breaking $1,000 or whatever on a record. But, you know, you're buying an artifact and a piece of history. And I think that's probably what people are paying for.
Along those lines, now that there's no money in music, what's your opinion of the Melvins model where they will put out just like they'll only put out like 300 of some of their records, right? And the covers are all like hand painted or whatever, but they're like $75 each instead of like 20 or 25. Is that a necessary evil? Is that cool? I mean, most of it's available digitally. What's your opinion of that? And actually Fucked Up kind of did the same thing with some of their 7 inches or 12 inches, like I think it's just called This Mother. That was like $60 when it came out. What's your opinion of, I guess, the fairly expensive new 12-inch limited edition?
I would say that it might come from when you start a band and you do everything on your own DIY style. Part of the fun of doing that is making it from the ground up, like making the covers, doing stuff yourself. I mean, you know, putting your own. You're physically touching each record and in the process. And I wonder if some of that with the Melvins releases comes from that kind of desire to like still be in control of it. And obviously if you're not going to sit there and do 30,000 seven inches, so you're going to do 300, but you know that someone's going to take them and flip them. So you're kind of forced to have to sell it for an inflated price, but at least you know that like, it's going directly to the band. It's not like, I guess it has a little bit more of a personal feel to it and charging that amount is, I understand. Cause if you just sell it, if they sold each one of those 7 inches for records for $10, one person would come in and buy all of them and then sell them on eBay for $300 a piece. And then they would take all the money. So you kind of like, your hands are kind of tied in that once you're at that level, you know, the Melvins are a really big band. I'm not against it. Any way you can make money in this business anymore, more power to you. So I don't have an opinion on that too hard.
Well, but then there's the flip angle. You're wearing a Fugazi t-shirt, and Fugazi famously started charging $5 for shows because that's about what it cost in like 1988 or so. And they kept charging $5 because it was almost like, I don't want to say a game, but they want to see if they could maintain that commitment, if you will. Now, if Fugazi got back together or whatever and they sold $5 tickets, people would buy them and flip them for $1,000, literally. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so what's Ian MacKaye supposed to do in that situation?
Just never step on stage with those bands again. And I think he's wise enough to know to never step on stage to do that either. It would tarnish the memory of the band. And also, not everybody has a lead singer that is a millionaire. You know, not everybody is Fugazi where they are making money hand over fist with their record label, you know, out of the house that they own. That their parents bought for them when they were in college or whatever. So some people got to hustle to make money. Fugazi could continue the $5 show thing because they were so big that people would come see them no matter where it was. And they could just afford to do it because they were Fugazi. They were selling a monumental amount of records on their own terms, taking a lot of money.
What kind of records do you collect?
I collect punk records and I collect reggae records.
R.I.P. Lee Scratch Perry, the greatest, the greatest.
Yeah, he's good.
Like who are your reggae go-tos?
Let's see. I like, I don't know. Let me think. Where do I start? I got bit by dub reggae pretty heavily, probably like 15 years ago or so. So I got pretty heavy into Scientist and Prince Jammy and King Tubby and Lee Perry and Prince Jammy and stuff on the Jammy label. I go by like labels a lot. So anything's on, like on Joe Gibbs or Jammy's or I don't know, a bunch of stuff. but I mean, I like all of reggae music. I even like dancehall and stuff. So, you know, when things went digital in the late 80s, early 90s, and dancehall kind of became, it started to mirror what was happening in hip hop, American hip hop culture. That's kind of a thing that I collect a lot of records of, kind of early dancehall too. Ninja Man, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Like Super Cat, Ninja Man, all that kind of stuff.
Ninja Man. Yeah. Stuff like that.
That's cool. That's cool. So I guess you collect mostly like 12 inch singles, not albums, or do you do both? Or
I have probably about 500 singles and then maybe 100 or so 12 inch singles. And then probably, a couple hundred LPs. LPs and reggae are punk and reggae is kind of interesting in that same thing of the 7-inch single where like a lot of artists in reggae only made one single and that was it. And they had their hit song on the A side and they had the dub version on the B side. And then that was the only thing that ever existed, you know? And once those records were pressed and not sold, sometimes they were melted down to make new records for other artists the next day. And so again, it's like reggae records sell for a lot of money because you're buying a finite a thing that, you know, it ended. You can't buy any more of them. But I don't know what I was talking about, but there's a similarity there with singles, I think, being the medium between punk and reggae for a long time. And now everything's just on the internet. Everybody just puts things up on YouTube and the culture moves way faster than I can keep up with now. But yeah, I don't know. I got bit by the reggae bug a while ago and started getting into that stuff.
Yeah, I love reggae. I'm seeing Yellow Man in a couple of weeks, which I'm super excited about. Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's really amazing that he's still alive. He's a real treasure. Yeah. He's barely holding on, but it's just amazing that he's still doing it. And his whole life story is just really inspiring. Like, he's a pretty amazing human.
You want to get philosophical, or do you want to talk more about punk records right now?
Whatever you want to do, man. Let's get
philosophical, then we'll talk about punk records. You know, in punk, especially right now, a big thing is, you know, self-care, wellness. It's okay to feel bad and feel sorry for yourself, you know. But on the other spectrum, you've got Yellow Man, if listeners don't know, Yellow Man's story is absolutely insane. He's born an albino. He's abandoned by his mom, not when he's like a baby, when he's like 7. So he like knows who his mom is. She abandons him. He doesn't get adopted. He says, I'm going to become a dancehall star. And in Jamaica then, and even now, being an albino is kind of like people will treat you poorly because you're albino, even now. Absolutely. You know? And so he's like, I don't care. I'm going to become a dancehall star. And now he's got Marfan syndrome on top of that, which is crazy. Yeah. So he becomes a super famous dancehall star. Then he gets cancer of the jaw. And his first doctor says, you're going to die in 2 weeks or 4 weeks. There's nothing I can do for you. He goes to another doctor. The doctor says, well, I can probably remove half your jaw. That might work. And he does it. And this guy's a singer, mind you, removes half his jaw and he survives. Then his backup guy, a guy called Fathead, gets murdered in a drug deal gone bad with machine guns. Then he gets cancer again and says, I'm not going to die. And every interview, he's like, every day I wake up thankful. I'm thankful. Yeah. You know, so we see Yellow Man, not I have problems. I have self-care. He's like, I will triumph because I'm Yellow Man and I'm thankful for every day. How do we balance those two things? Or do we need to, you know?
I don't think it's necessarily to balance those things. I mean, it just depends on where you come from. I mean, yeah. And like I said, super inspiring story. And also like to have like, you know, the confidence when he was the king of dancehall. I mean, that's his crown. That's his title from Jamaica, to stand on stage and have like, you know, slack lyrics talking about sex with women and stuff and kind of like make himself into this sex symbol in Jamaica is really awesome. It's great. It's a great story. as far as it, when it comes to punk and balancing mental health, is that what the question was? Or like positive and negative?
Like the question I'm constructing, and maybe it's a false question. Right now in punk rock, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Maybe it very well be a good thing. It's like, I need self-care. You know, I'm allowed to not do anything because I'm feeling bad, you know, and things are happening to me that is bad, and I just want to recover from that. Where Yellow Man's perspective is, I'm going to seize the day because I'm Yellow Man. I've cheated death three times.
Right. Yeah, the PMA kind of stuff. Like, get up, fucking wipe yourself off, and just keep trying. Yeah, that's, of course, that's super important. I mean, that's the whole spirit of punk. To me, is like, just keep trying, keep going. Like, I think there was a good quote from X in Decline of the Western Civilization where they were like, well, being alive is a lot more fun than being dead, which I think is just have fun. Yeah, shit sucks and you feel bad. There's going to be highs and lows. That's just natural progression of life.
What kind of punk records do you collect?
What kind of punk records? These days, I mean, I like power pop stuff. I like hardcore. I like, you know, when I say hardcore, it ends at like 1993 or something. you know, 80s to 90s American hardcore. Yeah, anything that I see that I'm like, oh, I like this, or I like this song, really. All sorts of punk.
So what are some of the crown jewels of your collection? Like, not necessarily your very favorite ones, but what are some of the ones you are thrilled to have in your collection?
Oh, man. I'd have to look over there. I've got, like, you know, some things that I stumbled into in the wild, some original Dead Kennedys pressings of Holiday in Cambodia and stuff. Nasty Facts record that I picked up in that same batch. I have a really, really awesome collection of Misfits bootleg records. They are, yeah, I found a guy who owns some sort of printing shop, and he was printing some Misfits records that were, you know, very, very detailed and spot on. And without, you know, searching the dead wax of the actual record, you wouldn't be able to tell. So I bought several copies of all of those, and those are pretty cool. Those are really great, because now I have like the whole collection of Misfits 7-inches and then some, and they look really cool, but I don't have to spend $3,000 a record or whatever it costs to own them.
We'll get to the copyrights in just a minute. Two things I want to ask you about. I'm a huge Misfits Danzig Sandman fan. So let's delve into the mind of Glenn Danzig. And maybe you might not have an answer. You know, okay. Danzig hates bootlegs. He hates bootlegs. Like, more than that, like, back in the day, if he would go into a shop and see a bootleg, he would demand the owner would give it to him, and he would break the bootleg which is rad. I support that 100%, you know. But then he won't repress Samhain and Misfits 7-inch. He owns them all. Why won't he repress them? Is it that he just doesn't care? Is it that he likes that there's some obscure artifact that no one can get, and that kind of makes him a cult, you know? Or is it just mismanagement? What's the answer?
Well, I would think it is it's the artifact. It's like, you know, Glenn made all that stuff. He did touch it. He silk screened all of that stuff in his parents' basement. And I think if he did come out and repress all the Misfits records, it totally would kind of maybe affect the market for original Misfits stuff. But it's so like through the roof that I think it might be a misstep to even mess with that. Like, it is. The fact that it does cost, you know, $20,000 to get a bullet record or whatever, it's not that high. But, you know, it's like, you know,
it almost is. It's like 12 grand.
Yeah. So, you know what I mean? It's like, that is a pretty, nobody can do that. And that makes them special. Why mess that up? There is an abundance of Samhain bootlegs that seem to exist all the time. And I kind of wonder if Glenn might have something to do with pressing those.
Why would he bootleg his own record, though? He owns them. Why not make real ones?
Because it might be more complicated to do it legit with a record label, where you could do something through the back door of just say, yeah, you can press 500 or 10,000 of these or whatever and pay me money. You know, there's so, so many of them that I wonder if, like, if he's just cool with getting a payment and then cutting out the middleman. Does he own, I mean, you know, I know Caroline took over the Misfits catalog. Does he, does he own that stuff still?
Ruby/Caroline owns Walk Among Us. He licensed to Caroline the remainder of the Misfits stuff, which he still technically owns.
Okay.
And actually, I think that Caroline contract has ended because he stopped Caroline from releasing 12 Hits from Hell, you see.
Right, right, yeah.
And he always owned Samhain, you know, and he did distribute through Caroline. But so your speculation is, I've never heard this theory, may very well be correct. Let's say a guy that has a printing press says, hey, Glenn, can I make 1,000 initiums? And Glenn will be like, sure, give me $10,000 and you can do it. Something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah.
That you may have solved.
You know what I mean?
I like that theory. I like that theory. Yeah. That puts a lot of puzzle pieces together. One last question that we will get into copyrights. You, like I, are also a Ghetto Boys fan, right?
I do like the Ghetto Boys. Yeah.
And do you like Mr. Scarface's Back, the first Mr. Scarface solo record?
Man, I don't. I didn't take the journey into Scarface's solo.
Oh, okay.
Record. Yeah, I kind of left it at Ghetto Boy stuff. I mean, I do know the importance of Scarface, but it was just one of those things. I just never, never went down that rabbit hole. What do you got though?
Well, it goes back to Ghetto Boys too. Here's something that troubles me in the modern punk and modern hip hop discourse is it, like, do you know, like Trippie Redd? He's like a really famous guy right now.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or like Migos. They've got a lot of like, so Pitchfork will be like, the new Trippie Redd single is fantastic. It's great. You know? And then the single will be like, bitch this, bitch that, my dick this, my dick that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then if a punk record, if a punk guy said that, he would be blown out of the world. Yeah. You know what I mean? Even like Pitchfork wouldn't cover that band.
Right.
So why do we have this? And meanwhile, this is not an anti. There is a ton of amazing hip hop that doesn't do that. Run the Jewels. Megan Thee Stallion is sexual, but it's definitely a different vibe. You know what I mean? Nicki Minaj is a different vibe. I love all those acts, you know? So why? And I see a lot of punk rockers like loving Migos or Trippie Redd and that kind of stuff. Why do we hold punk to a higher standard that way than other genres? You know what I mean?
I don't know if those criticisms would come from journalism. I mean, I guess it would come from journalism, but, you know, with punk, it is supposed to represent a certain kind of ethos. Like when you give something the label of punk, I think anymore now you're adopting a style. This is what it, you know what it sounds like, right? It has loud guitars, it has loud drums, it has somebody screaming. And it also has some sort of ethos. And what that is kind of not reality. I mean, there's, you know, it's supposed to be anti-capitalist or anti-government or anti-whatever, or against this and against that and for this and for that. It's kind of a term of no real meaning. But I definitely think that it would be more criticism amongst the punk audience as opposed to coming from Pitchfork on account of the lyrics being too sexual. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't read Pitchfork. I don't fucking know. But I can tell you that the punk community would definitely not stand for that kind of stuff. It's a self-policing kind of thing. Whereas hip hop has always been that. It's always been those subjects have always been things people rap about. So it's just part of their culture of hip hop, you know?
See, I would disagree with you to the fact that the quote punk community wouldn't stand for it. I see lots of punk rockers and even lots of like uber political punk bands like saluting those records. People play
Fuck the Police at a Black Lives Matter protest or whatever, but they don't skip to the next song, which is like, you know, you go a couple tracks down and you're like, this isn't right. Like, you can't play this in public. You know, this is about women. You know, this is sexual assault on a record. That kind of thing is like, you're just kind of turning a blind eye and picking and choosing the artist politics, I guess.
Well, I guess everybody's a hypocrite in their own way. I mean, it's impossible not to be a hypocrite, at least in some aspect in your life, unless you're like Ian MacKaye maybe or something.
Well, it is, but I mean, there's some, I think there's some glaring misogyny within hip hop, obviously. And that gets a pass. You're right. It does get a pass. Why? I don't know. But I think that the criticisms, if you know, if we came out and had some terrible lyrics about, you know, some shit that NWA said, obviously, I think our fans and the punk community would be the first to point the finger at that and say, that's not what we want. You know, that's not what we want in our scene. Whereas, like, the person in Pitchfork just gets a record from whatever record label when they're, it might be Machine Gun Kelly for all they know. Fuck, I don't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the copyrights. The copyrights, I'm going to read just some of, and I'll say, like I said, Adam, I'm not trying to dog on you, and we're going to get to that. I don't love the copyrights. I don't hate the copyrights. Sure. I actually saw you guys open for, I think it was you guys open for Classics of Love in like a video arcade in like 2008. Was that you guys?
Wow. What town was that? In California?
It's San Jose or Milpitas. San Jose, I guess.
You were at San Jose?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
So I don't dislike the copyrights, but I don't love the copyrights. But that's not what's important. Here's what's important. Listen to some of these people talking about this band. It's about damn time. The copyrights are the best pop punk band of the last 20 years, in my opinion. They should have signed a fat a long time ago. And this is someone else. An actual text I sent my friend back in February. I got so sad when I found out the copyrights have a new album that's been recorded and done for almost 2 years, but they were waiting to release until they can tour again. Today, all that sadness goes away. Here's someone else. This is exactly what I need in my life. Here's someone else. Awesome song. Looking forward to hearing the rest of the album. I honestly think the copyrights will never release an album that I wouldn't love. Here's someone else. This is the best day of my life. When you play at Hangar 9, I'll be up front. So unanimous approval of the new copyrights single, which is called Halos, and that's off the new album, Alone in the Dome, coming out in October on Fat Records. So here's the question. What is the purpose of the copyrights? Do you guys have a goal? Artistically, that is. Not financially, but artistically.
An artistic goal?
Yes.
Well, I mean, our goal is to write good songs, perform them well, and make good records and have fun while we're doing it, and that's pretty much our goal. That's where we're at. We don't have we've been a band for a long time, so our goals have already been reached at this point, I suppose. So yeah, that's kind of our goal. Pretty easy.
What's interesting about Halos to me is it's very sing-songy, it's very digestible. And to me, feel free to disagree. To me, it feels built to welcome the audience. Would you agree with that?
Sure. I think it's probably everything packed into a minute and a half. So it's kind of like, here's a quick introduction to our band, and it sounds like this, and there it is in a minute and a half, and no stops. And yeah, kind of the most straightforward song on the record.
At Punk News, we kind of have this theory that we've been testing now for 10 years, and I think it holds up, in that you can roughly break punk into two zones. There's the danger zone, the chaos zone, where anything goes. It's not safe, but in that danger and relaxation of safety, perhaps you can achieve something new artistically and weird, like the Screamers, like the Germs, that kind of stuff.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Or even like Bad Canoes or Screaming Females. By contrast, there's the other side. It's, I don't fit in, you know, I don't really agree with my parents or whatever, or I'm feeling alone. Here's a group of people that will welcome me, and we have a similar set of ideals, and in our collection, we can be stronger together than individually.
Gotcha.
So to me, and feel free to disagree, this copyright song seems to not want to cause danger or upset people, but comfort people and make them feel together and as one.
Yeah, but sure. And I would say most of our songs are like that. Mm-hmm. They're all kind of big chorus sing-along stuff. That's what we like.
So why do we go there? I mean, and I'm not saying that's wrong. Why do we take that avenue instead of like the assault the audience side of things? Like any power violence band where they would like upset the audience, you know?
Okay, I understand. Yeah, there are two different approaches. And that shit doesn't work well in a big stage, in a big room. Like if you're in a, I've told this story before. We played Groz Rock with, this was years ago, and Rancid played one night, and it was amazing because, you know, there's 20,000 people singing every single lyric to Rancid, and it's just the whole crowd singing along to every song. Shit's magical. Then Refused played the next day. Refused, great band, love Refused. While I was standing there watching them, it just didn't work in that setting.
Mm.
It's in a, you know, in a room with 20,000 people, and there's somebody trying to play like extremely technical hardcore on stage. It just, there was nothing to hold on to. It's just white noise and lights and shouting. And it was kind of, it just wasn't, it's just not fun. So when you get to that kind of, I don't know, when you get a big group of people together, there's nothing more fun than everybody singing along. It's that's the best part about punk rock and community. Yeah.
See, what's interesting, and I think neither of us are wrong, is to you, the best part of punk rock is community and singing along with friends, which certainly is a very valuable thing.
Yeah.
To me, the best part of punk rock is the danger and the craziness and the things you haven't thought of before, you right. know, and I guess that's where our differences of opinions comes from. You know what I mean? And I right. wonder, is that the result of it? Like, and feel free not to answer. Growing up, did you have a happy home life? Like get along with your parents and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much to most degree. Yeah. I mean, I definitely, had my, I don't fit in. I grew up in a really small town. I mean, like, we're talking like 3,000 people. So, you know, it was like a square peg in a round hole. But, you know, my parents, I wasn't like a totally bad kid. I wasn't like, you know, doing drugs and getting drunk all the time. I was just going to shows and playing music, but doing it like not in an asshole way. So I didn't have much confrontation with my parents. Like, they didn't try to stop me from doing that. I think they recognized early on that I was driven to play music. So they just let me do it. And, but I know what you mean. I'm not against the idea of abrasive music or like the idea of, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, harsh noise or power violence or black metal or whatever it is. I just think those things only work within the certain confines of a venue.
Hmm.
Of a certain size. Like, those things only work, they don't necessarily, like, you can't, you know, I'm not gonna put like Crass in a hockey arena. Like, it's just not gonna sound good. Def Leppard might. You know, those songs are written to sound like good in a hockey arena. So the venue, I think, has a lot to do with how things work, and punk is normally in a small club, a small dead room where you can play loud guitars and drums really fast, and it works out. But, you know, I don't know. I'm just rambling now. Singing along is important. And like Cox Bar is a great band. You know, they have a little bit of, they're an oi band, but they're like the best pop punk band. So that kind of thing is something that we took into consideration with our bands. It was like, we like the big sing along. Misfits too. I mean, the best woe band, Naked Ray Gun, the second best woe band.
Well said. I like your very pragmatic or practical answer. It's the room, which people often take the hoity-toity artistic approach, but you're like, it's a very physical explanation, which I enjoy. Is it true that you recorded this record 2 years ago and had to wait to put it out, or is that not true?
That is true. Yeah, we recorded it in 2019.
What's it like sitting on a record for 2 years?
Pretty weird. Yeah, we did it, and then I was just in no rush to put it out at the time, and then the pandemic happened, and then it was like, well, let's just stop doing everything, let's just take a break for a minute and then wait till things start to pick up again. And then, yeah, about a year, well, I guess it was almost a year ago at this time, I can't remember, Fat was like, you know, interested in doing it, wanted to put it out, so it worked out in our benefit.
So do you have that thing where like a new record comes out and the fans are like, oh, this brand new track is amazing, but to you it's already an old song because it's like 3 or 4 years old?
You know, kind of. We've heard it a million times, but we haven't played it. We've only had one band practice in the last 2 years when we just tried to play through some of these new songs, so they're still really fresh. So yeah, we're not totally sick of them yet. I'm sick of listening to them, I guess, but not sick of playing them yet. We're still figuring that part out.
What's Halos about?
That's a good question. And, you know, Luke, the drummer, is the main songwriter. So that would probably be a question more well suited for him if you wanted to get into the real details of it.
Well, how about the title Alone in a Dome? Is that like a COVID reference or is that like something else?
There is a line in the first song that says you'll die alone in a Bucky Dome. And Buckminster Fuller was the creator of the Geodesic Dome. He was also a professor here at Southern Illinois University, which is the town where I live and where our band is kind of located, but we don't all live here anymore. And his dome home is just blocks away, just down the road from where I live. So it ties into our region, like where we're from. And it's also kind of a play on, you know, the world, the dome.
Yeah. Do you feel like this is like your strongest record? Because it definitely seems like the fans think that like this is the jam, at least the one track released so far.
It's pretty strong. It's a good one. And we worked we worked on it for a couple of years, so we didn't want to release anything that we didn't feel was completely solid. Yeah, it's up there.
I'm going to throw concept at you, and you might disagree with this concept.
Okay.
So if you read like Rolling Stone, like mid to late 70s, if you read like Spin, Cream, all those interviews aren't rah, 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 this band is the best, let's sell this record. Like there's this one I love with Mick Jagger from like 1978, where they're talking about like French expressionism from the 30s in the interview, and the album's about some girls. Like, why are they even talking about it? You know what I mean? And right. I feel like modern interviews, especially in the punk world, are very much rah, rah, let's talk about the new album and sell it, rah.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
And honestly, I think the 70s interviews are way better in content. However, I think that publicists and labels, particularly in the age of mass social media where they don't have to rely on magazines, have recognized that they have more power now than they used to. So they can sort of demand a rah-rah interview or else you don't get an interview. And the rah-rah interviews perhaps sell more records than Mick Jagger talking about French expressionism from the 40s. Do you agree with that concept?
I do. I see exactly what you mean. It's more of just like a press release with a couple of quotes tossed in to just let everybody know that, hey, there's a record coming out. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of depth.
So it's difficult for you to answer this because you have a vested interest. But what's the better interview? What should we as fans and as artists and as bands, what kind of discourse should we be aiming towards now in 2021?
With interviews?
Yeah, or reviews, you know.
Well, you know what? The podcast is great because it's kind of an open-ended discussion. You can that format never really existed, so now you can really dive into artists. I love that kind of two-person just interview podcast type of thing. As far as like, man, I don't know. As far as press release stuff, shit, I don't know. Just talk about whatever you want to talk about.
in the 80s, we saw the rise of like Attack interviews, where like the interview would like attack the person in the band. You know what I mean? And like I know Hall and Oates used to take a beating, and actually Tegan and Sarah, before like social media was big, they would take beatings, like just crazy beatings for like no reason. You know, certainly it can be enjoyable to read those. But they're so mean. I mean, do you enjoy the Attack interview? That doesn't, honestly, I'm not really a fan of Vice, but Vice kind of got famous for Attack interviews. They were like interview, like, you know.
Are you like prepping me for some sort of attack?
No, I'm not. I'm interested in having an open discussion with you.
Okay.
Because frankly,
I have never been attacked in an interview. I don't really have anything to be attacked about. So I'm not worried about that at all.
No, well, I'm thrilled we're having this conversation because, like I said, most bands that I interview now are bands that I'm a big fan of just because I have limited time. But this interview came up, and I thought it'd be a very interesting opportunity to have a truly unique and honest conversation about interviews. And should an interviewer only interview bands he likes, or should he interview any band or a band he doesn't like? You know what I mean?
No, why would you only want to interview people you like? That sounds boring.
Yeah, well, see, but there's our problem is because record labels and PR have more power, and maybe they should have that power, it's harder to do a negative. Like I read an interview from Rolling Stone from like 1980, and it's pretty harsh on you. It's an interview with Yoko Ono, and it's harsh on Yoko Ono. You could never do that today. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's tough to set up that kind of an interview.
Right. Well, you can knock me down all you want, man. I got nothing to lose.
Well, I'm not gonna knock you down because I like you for coming on this podcast and sticking to your guns. But I do wonder, and like, is an interview where the main the subject is either presented as being kind of weird or unusual or not all put together, maybe that does generate as much interest as the "This guy's great," you know. Even when they do interviews now with, like, they'll do like Bad Bunny, like, you know, he had troubles with the law, but now that's over. It's never like, you know, he's got so and so has drug problems and they might kill him, and that's where we're at. We never get those interviews anymore. I'm not sure if that's good or bad for bands. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I know what you
mean. We don't get the Johnny Thunders is in a bad state right now, and no one knows what's going to happen. You don't get that interview anymore. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. True.
So I don't know if anybody. So let's talk about Kepi Ghouli. I'm a big fan. Really like the record you guys did with Kepi Ghouli. You guys did Reanimation Festival. First question. So if the listeners don't know, the Copyrights re-recorded all of Groovy Ghouli's Reanimation Festival with Kepi, and it was called Kepi and the Copyrights Reanimation Festival. First question is, why do you guys call it Reanimation Festival?
Man, I had that idea. Yeah. I pitched it. It just got labeled Reanimation Festival for whatever reason. So I did. You're not the first.
I interviewed Kepi once briefly, and it was an experience. What was Kepi like as a person to you?
Oh, he is a hyperactive. He's a rock and roll shark. We've spent a lot of time together throughout the years. So he's a force. He's rocking 24/7.
Is Kepi on stage the same person as Kepi off stage?
That's right. Yeah, he is always on.
So, I mean, he's made a lot of great records. But I would think if I'm in a van with this guy and he's going, hooray, yay, I love goats, I love bats, I'd be like, I'd want to strangle the guy. I mean, did you feel that way? Or...
Yeah, you know, that has happened from time to time. But we still love each other. And that's just what happens with your family. The Copyrights are kind of like, you can tell we're all dead silent, crumbled up, sleeping off our hangover all day in the van while Kepi's like looking out the window, looking at goats eating ice cream cones. Yeah, that's pretty much how it goes.
What was the decision to re-record? Like, I would have loved to have like either a studio version or maybe a live in studio version of your set list. Why re-record that one album as a whole? Because I think he owns the rights to the original one anyway.
He's re-recording them with other bands. So the Accelerators did Fun in the Dark. And I think the Mean Jeans did a record too that maybe never came out. I don't really know. Or they were going to do one.
I think that's breaking news. That hasn't come out, but maybe that's lingering around in the background.
Maybe it was an idea that just got tossed out. Maybe they never did it. But he was planning on doing a little series where he re-recorded the old Groovy Ghoulies records, you know, with new bands. And we recorded that one a long time. It sat for several years. I think there's a video on YouTube of us playing that whole set live in Baltimore. And I feel like it was like 2015 or something. It was a long time ago. And then we recorded the record shortly after that show. And then it sat for several years. We had just kind of like handed it off to Kepi to do his vocals and then finish the rest of it. And it just kind of got pushed away in the back burner for several years. And then when it came out, we went over and did a couple weeks of Europe and did a few shows here in the Midwest. And it was fun. It was good. I love that record. That was our introduction to the Groovy Ghoulies, was that record. So it was really fun for us to like just get to do what we do on it. I think it turned out really good.
Why we record a whole album? Like, why did he want to do that?
I don't know. It's just fun.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, there's nothing wrong with having fun.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do. Hey, let's just re-record the whole record. And we did it our way. We cut the songs down and added some stuff here and there. Did Copyright style on it.
So, Adam, how are you feeling right now? Are you feeling good? Are you feeling down? Where are you at in your life right now?
My life? I'm pretty good. Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, I've been I've just been locked in my house for a couple years like everybody else. being dad.
Are you excited? So. Are you excited to get back out on the road?
Yes and no. Things are just kind of weird right now with COVID, so I don't really know what to expect. You know, yeah. Like I said, my favorite part of punk is like that kind of community aspect of it, of like people singing along and dancing and jumping around and, you know, rubbing into each other, breathing each other's air. So that's kind of a thing that's not safe right now for a lot of people. So I'm a little bit hesitant to step back into it and have it suck, you know, in that way.
Yeah.
I'm not really stoked about that. But at the same time, like, we have a record that we're really proud of and it's coming out. And I feel like it's important that we play some shows to let people know we're still a band and try to play those songs for people.
Well, the new record is out October 22nd, Alone in a Dome, by Fat Records. You can still get the record and the CD. And so that'll be cool. And anything else you want to talk about, Adam? Anything else you want the listeners to know about?
We've got some shows coming up that weekend, October 22nd, Indianapolis, Milwaukee, and Chicago. And just, I don't know, we'll be probably playing some stuff in the wintertime.
All right. Should we play Halos? Should we give
go
that a
for
spin?
It. Sure.
All right. Well, Adam, thanks for coming by. I appreciate you stepping up to the podcast and hanging out. And
thanks for having me.
All the best wishes. And this is Halos by The Copyrights. I guess we finally crossed the